Last week, Charles said something about those who have tried to identify the various characters of Revelation. For example, the two witnesses and the beast of Revelation. How many of you, by the way, think you know who the beast is? And he asked that same question. I believe he mentioned me by name and said something. Not that I was the beast, but that he figured I didn't know who it was either. If I did, I would say so. Well, I remember over the years, many years ago, fortunately, it's not anything we've experienced in the Church of God International, but there were people claiming, going around, like I'm thinking especially of one evangelist who would travel around back in the previous organization, and he would say, seemingly, I guess it was speculation, but he seemed to come across rather dogmatically that he did know who the two witnesses were. And, you know, he laid out this scenario. And even then, when I thought it was all exciting to hear all these things, I still had the question in my mind, said, what's the real proof here? Is there any real proof? And I knew that it had to be speculation and not proof at all. As it turns out, it was not true at all. I also remember very well when, I believe Charles mentioned this last week, when Franz Josef Strauss was thought to be, or at least it was speculated to be, that he was the beast in Revelation 13. And you know, he was invited at one point to Ambassador College. He came there, he visited in the home of Herbert Armstrong. Garner Ted gave him a rifle as a gift. And Charles once said, I thought as an insightful comment, he once made the statement, said, if you think this guy is a beast, if you think you're one of the two witnesses, why on earth would you give him a rifle? Rather insightful, and that's something I don't think I would want to do if I thought I had any kind of importance in God's plan, and I recognized who this beast figure was. I don't think I would give him a weapon that he could use on me at some point. Franz Josef Strauss was called in the press in Europe the strong man of Europe, and of course they picked up on that right away, the strong man of Europe. Thinking that perhaps this is the guy. He wrote a book entitled The Grand Design. It was on the unification of Europe. And apparently, at least from what I've read, apparently when he visited Ambassador College, he did know what they were saying about him. And they still gave him a rifle, because he was intrigued by it. He never believed it, of course, himself, but he was intrigued by it. And he played along with the attention that was given to him. Well, I remember very well, I would say it's probably in 1990, somewhere along in there. There was an elderly lady, many years in the Church of God movement, going way back in the Worldwide Church of God, and she would call me from time to time, usually on a Sunday afternoon, and she would like to talk about some of these things. Now remember that Strauss died on October 3rd in 1988. I think this was about 1990 or so. She said, well, I still believe that Franz Josef Strauss is the beast. And she didn't know that he had died. Said, well, I think that's probably ruled out by now. I don't think that he's going to be the one. And remember, talk about the great false prophet, the false prophet that's mentioned in Revelation. I remember the excitement back when Pope Paul VI died, and it was an announcement. There was a new pope. And we wanted to have, maybe something like Peter the Sixth or the 66th or whatever. Wanted some of this stuff in there that indicated that he was the guy. Well, it was kind of a disappointment that it was John Paul the First. Certainly, he just didn't have the appearance for it. Then all of a sudden, he dies, and here comes this charismatic guy, a Polish guy. That was okay, I guess. He wasn't quite German enough, I suppose, but he was a Polish pope, and he was charismatic, and he could move crowds, and he had this voice. Of course, he was an actor in his younger years, and he could really move the audience, and that was impressive. We're thinking, is this the guy? Is this him? Like I say, he wasn't German enough, but guess what? We've got a German guy now. He was in the United States recently. He visited with the president of the United States. Very soft-spoken, one of the greatest intellectuals in the Roman Catholic Church today. But I'm guessing that he's not it. He's not it. In fact, if in Europe, if there was a massive persecution broke out against Seventh-day Adventists and Seventh-day Baptists and other Sabbath-keeping Christian groups, you know, he would be the guy who would be the first one to defend their rights as to freedom of religion. Some people don't think so. Oh, he would. He absolutely would. So I don't think he qualifies as the false prophet. Now, again, how many of you think you know who the beast and the false prophet are? Any takers on that? Anybody want to identify who the beast is? Well, I can identify him, and I'm going to do so today. Not only am I going to identify the beast, I'm going to identify the false prophet, and I'm going to identify the great harlot of Babylon, all of them. And I'm certain of my understanding. Sound you look excited. Okay. Okay, first of all, I think it's important that when we read these texts in Revelation, that we get inside the minds of the people who first received it. One of the most important rules of biblical interpretation is that you understand the text in light or from the point of view as best as possible of the people who first received the text. You know, we all bring something to the text. We bring our 20th and 21st century way of thinking to the text. Oftentimes we read these texts over here in Revelation, all these apocalyptic things going on, and we read what we know about the universe and the solar system and the earth and the cataclysmic events and political events and so on. We tend to bring it to the text. It's a natural thing. You can't help but do that to some extent. So one of the very first principles of good biblical interpretation is that we get inside the minds of the people who first received that revelation and then understand it from their point of view. Now, that's not to say that there's not additional meanings, things they didn't see and didn't understand. But in order to have the foundation for a good understanding, you have to get inside their minds and see it from their point of view. Now, in Revelation chapter 1, verse 4, we read right away who the revelation was to. He says, John, to the seven churches which are in Asia. To whom? The seven churches. So it's important to understand what we read in this text from the point of view of those people who made up the seven churches in Revelation. And these were seven literal churches. He names them later in chapter 1. He names them for example, in verse 11, he says, he says again midway through the passage, he says, to the seven churches which are in Asia, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamos, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. And we know these were literal congregations that existed then. And if they represent anything other than that, if they represent eras, as we have believed in the past, or some of us have, then we must admit that the text does not say so. The text simply does not say so. So we do know, and I think everyone would agree to the fact that there were seven actual churches there. So again, let's understand the conditions, the circumstances that they were facing. Let's understand how they would have understood these words as they heard them or read them. And then we're prepared to understand get an idea of who the beast and the false prophet and the great harlot and all these other people were. Or things, people or things or systems, whatever they were. Now, in chapter 1, let's go back and... Well, first of all, let me just summarize some history there without going through a lot of scriptures. Many cities in that day were considered outposts of Rome. At a certain point in time, Rome's population was a very crowded place. And so many people began to go to other places. They were moved to other places in the provinces of the empire. And they were considered citizens of Rome, even though they were now removed from the city of Rome itself. They were a part of it. So they were outposts, as it were. And these people looked to the Caesars, the Roman rulers, for their protection from invasion from outside. They had a certain comfort in knowing that if an outside invader came along, if someone was trying to come in and bring in a different system of government, they knew that they were Roman citizens and that their Lord and Savior, that's the way they looked at him, Caesar, He was their Lord. They looked on him as their Savior. Their Lord and Savior would come riding in on his white horse, the symbol of victory, leading his legions. That sounds similar to something else we read about another Lord and Savior in the Scriptures, doesn't it? That's the way they looked at it. And, of course, that was the confidence. That was their assurance from an outside invasion that Caesar would protect them, for after all, they were Roman citizens. Now, the Romans deified the dead emperors. Early on, apparently, they began deifying, making gods out of dead emperors. You know, you can see them up in the constellation and so on. You see the various stars that are named after them and so on. They've gone on to be with the other gods. But there came a point in time when it was recognized that the use of religion was a good way, an effective way at least, I won't use the word good necessarily, an effective way of controlling the masses. And of course, that became more and more critical as the empire expanded. It's difficult to control a larger area. But the emperors came to realize that the use of religion, in this case, the deification of Roman emperors, served as an effective way of controlling people. Now, at some point, rather than deify only the dead emperors, the living emperors began claiming to be gods and demanding worship. Not a lot, you know, maybe burn a little incense once a year, hang a wreath on the door showing that you are in full allegiance to the Roman emperor, recognizing him as a god, one of many other gods. It's all right if you had other gods, that's fine. There are lots of gods in Rome. And or worship of them was encouraged in many quarters. It's okay as long as you acknowledge the God of gods himself, the Roman emperor. So this is what the people had to contend with. Now you can imagine what kind of problem that was for Christians. And the people in these provinces in Asia Minor, in these seven churches, many of them at least, had to deal with that. In addition to that, there was the imperial cult that enforced the worship of the emperor. You know, if you're far away from Rome, you think, well, it's not going to affect me very much. People in Rome may be required to do this, but it's not going to affect me. But no, there was the imperial cult, the priesthood that belonged to the emperor, who would go around and see to it that emperor worship was enforced. So you had that religious element going on there. Also, membership in trade guilds and participation in pagan guild feasts were important to economic security. And by the way, if you didn't acknowledge Caesar as a god, you were faced with economic deprivation, or in some cases, possibly even the death sentence. That's how serious it was. In the trade guilds, you basically had to be a member of a trade guild in order to, kind of like a union, in order to have economic prosperity and not be cut out, as it were. It was important. A person could be or should be, I won't say should be because it's a bad thing to do, to be when you understand what was going on there. The trade guilds were really guilds where they honored and worshipped other gods, and where they were required to do things such as eat things sacrificed to idols, and also all kinds of sexual immorality was going on within those guild feasts. And the Christians, because they did not participate in those things, were looked upon, and because they did not honor the other gods, were looked upon as atheists. They were actually called atheists. You believe in the gods? No, I believe only in the one God. Well, they were atheists. They were also called haters of mankind because they withdrew from unacceptable social life, especially that which was associated with the trade guilds. So this is what the people in Revelation 2 and 3, the churches there, were having to confront in their day-to-day lives. This is the kind of pressure they were exposed to. Now, there were those who were called the Nicolaitans. We read about them in Revelation 2. We're not going to go into all of these different descriptions, but just simply to briefly summarize them. The doctrine of the Nicolaitans is mentioned there, the doctrine of Balaam, and the doctrine or the teachings of that woman Jezebel. These were no doubt all variations of the same doctrine. And that is, it was a way to go ahead and participate in idolatrous worship and fornication and the like, and still call yourself a Christian. That's what it amounted to. So it was a doctrine that lured people, said it's okay to go ahead and do this. you know, like Adam and Eve and the forbidden fruit. So they were saying it's okay to participate in these idolatrous festivals. Now, had you been there, I'm going to ask you this question. Turn over, if you're still in Revelation 1. Had you been in those circumstances and a member of one of the churches in Asia, how would you understand verses 1 through 3, chapter 1? It says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ to all things that he saw. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Notice this word, shortly take place, and time is near. Here you are facing persecution, facing economic deprivation, possibly no people who have been put to death because of their refusal to acknowledge the Emperor God. People have been basically shunned by society because they won't participate in the trade guild feasts and so on and worship the false gods. And now you hear an apostle of Jesus Christ with a message, or he sends a message to you, members of the seven churches, and saying the time is near. Would you start thinking, well, this must be for 2,000 years from now? No, you wouldn't. You would think it had something to do with the situation you were facing right then and right there. And as we look at the book of Revelation, we find that indeed it did. Indeed it did. Now, it doesn't stay there. Indeed, we find later on a description of the new heaven and the new earth. We find the millennial reign in Revelation 20 and other things. So it doesn't mean every last thing in the book of Revelation would be happening right then and there. But what it does mean is the things they were facing that John was, or God, Christ through John, was addressing them. And now we're beginning to get to the place where we can figure out who the beast was. Let's go to Revelation 12, who the beast is. I'm giving it away before time. In Revelation chapter 12, we've gone through this before, but let me just give a little brief summation of it. We see in here several characters. We see a woman who was clothed with the sun, had the moon under her feet, a crown of 12 stars. We see a great red dragon who had 7 heads and 10 horns. And we see a male child that the woman gives birth to. And the dragon was there. If you read the whole text, you'll see all these things. The dragon was there. The 7-headed dragon was there waiting for the birth of the child. And the child was caught up of God. And it says that he would rule all nations with a rod of iron. Of course, we know who the child is, don't we? He's identified in Revelation chapter 2 and in Psalm chapter 2, of course, as the Christ, the Messiah. So this is obviously the Messiah. Who would then be the woman who gives birth to her? That would be the ideal Zion. The ideal Zion. Now some say it's Israel. Some say it's the church. Well, in a sense it is. It's the ideal Zion. You know, we're told, the Apostle Paul tells us that the Jerusalem above is the mother of us all. The book of Hebrews speaks of Zion, the city of the living God, and coming to Zion, the city of the living God, and to a multitude of angels, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and so on. So this is the ideal Zion. If you want to associate it with a literal people, then associate it with the remnant of Israel, which still existed in the time of Christ. There had always been an Israel within Israel. In the time of Christ, in the time that in which he was born, that would include Zacharias and Elizabeth. It would include Joseph and Mary. It would include Anna, the prophetess that we read about in the book of Luke. It would include Simeon, who awaited, who prayed to God that he would see the Messiah before his death. Of course, he did. And many others of those who were faithful to the covenant. This would be the remnant of Israel, not Israel as a whole. So this is the ideal Zion. She gives birth to the male child. Christ was born to the righteous remnant of Israel, to the ideal Zion. The red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. Keep that description in mind. 7 heads, 10 horns. Is awaiting the birth of Christ. And he tries to kill him, but God delivers him. Now, did somebody try to kill Christ? Remember the text? Remember the scriptures? Who was it? It was Herod, was it not, who sought to kill Christ? Remember the account of what's called the slaughter of the innocents? He tried to kill Christ. Who gave Herod his authority? Well, this tells us, of course, this, obviously it's Satan. But on the human level, in our world, that's the power behind the scenes, obviously, Satan is. But it was the Roman Empire who gave Herod his authority and the power he used in trying to kill Christ. So keep in mind, here Satan, the real power behind the throne, is described as having 7 heads and 10 horns. And he goes after later, we see that he is cast down here in the book of, in chapter 12. He's cast down. Reading about that in drop on down to verse 13. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. This is not about the Philadelphia church fleeing to a place of safety. It's not anything to do with it. It's just God's protection upon the woman, the ideal Zion here. But then what does the devil do? What does the devil do? Remember, she has the one offspring, the male child. It says man-child there in your King James Version. But the male child, who is Christ, we have identified as Christ, is the offspring. Satan, through Herod, tries to kill Christ as soon as he is born or shortly thereafter, attempts to kill him. And now we see that the serpent, notice what it says here, who else he goes after, says, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood, but the earth helped the woman. And so now verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. Remember, the first offspring was the male child, Christ. Now she has other offspring. That would be Christ's brothers and sisters. That would be Christians. That would be the church. Not the Laodicean church, as some of us were taught in the past, but the church, period. Goes after the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, chapter 13 tells us precisely how he goes after the rest of her offspring. John looks and he sees a beast coming out of the sea. This beast is described with the imagery taken from Daniel chapter 7. In verse 2 says, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority. Obviously a kingdom, because this is a description given to a series of kingdoms, actually back in the book of Daniel. The Babylonian kingdom, you know, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greco-Macedonian, and finally the Roman Empire. So this is obviously a reference to a governmental system. Notice the description, though, back in verse 1. It said, I stood on the sea, the sand of the sea. Some translations or some manuscripts say he stood, meaning Satan stood on the sand of the sea to summons the beast, in other words. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. He looks a lot like the devil, doesn't he? So you see the association here, don't you? You see, first of all, in chapter 12, you see the devil described as having 7 heads and 10 horns. It's not a literal description. It's symbolic. And we see that he's given this description because we know who he worked through in trying to kill the male child. Herod, whose power was taken from or was granted him by the Roman Empire. So what is this beast, the 7 heads and 10 horns? Again, it's a description of the Roman Empire, obviously. And here, this beast has all the characteristics of those preceding empires, as you see in verse 2 there. Now, again, let me remind you that we're trying to keep our minds in the minds of those people who first received this. And we know some things that they knew. They knew about the Roman Empire. They were subjected to it and to its power. So when they read this, I'm quite sure they did not scratch their heads and say, what in the world could this be talking about? They knew the symbolism backward and forward. They knew exactly who it was talking about. They were experiencing the persecution under the Roman rulers. And this was probably written in the time of the reign of Domitian. Some say it was during the reign of Nero, which was earlier, but I think probably is. Most scholars do agree it was the reign of Domitian. Either way, both of them were pretty notorious emperors. Both of them persecuted Christians. Remember, Nero was the guy who fiddled while Rome burned. And even though there's evidence that he caused it, he found a scapegoat. He blamed it on the Christians. Then they burned them. But under the reign of Domitian, you also have persecution going on. And this is probably during the reign of Domitian. And the people in these provinces, in these cities of Asia Minor, knew the history. At least they had heard. They didn't have CNN. They didn't have a good fair and balanced reporting like Fox News or anything like that. But they did have sources of news. It circulated, and they picked up whatever was circulated. Some of it might have been rumor. And indeed, I think it's possible that John makes use of some rumor, as we will see a little later. But nevertheless, they had an idea as to what was going on in the world of the Roman emperors, and they knew immediately who the beast was. And I said I was going to identify the beast. I just did. It's the Roman Empire. It's Imperial Rome. And notice I said who the beast was. That's who the beast was. A little disappointment there, I'm sure. But nevertheless, this is who the beast was. He goes on to describe this beast. It says in verse 4, "So they worshipped," meaning his subjects, "worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him?'" That's the way they looked on the Caesars, the Roman rulers. "And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. But what does it really mean? Is it an actual literal 3.5 years? Now, what does he do for those 42 months? Well, you read it in the text here. It said, "Then he opened his mouth and blasphemed against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation." So what happened? What was he doing for these 42 months? Whether you take it as literal or not, what was he doing? He was persecuting the saints. What is 42? But 3.5. And what is 3.5 but 7? A half of 7. A broken 7. What is 7? It's the number for fullness. So the fullness of the suffering of the saints, this suggests to me, was that God intervened and, you might say, broke it in half. He cut it off before that full number could be destroyed. But he did allow the beast to make war with the saints. He said, "All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb and slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall be led into captivity. He who kills with a sword will be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints." So this is what the beast is doing during this period. He's persecuting the saints, among other things, of course. Now he goes on to describe a second beast. This one doesn't come out of the sea. This one comes out of the earth. He's described as having two horns like a lamb, yet he speaks like a dragon. The Seventh-day Adventists are wrong. This is not the United States of America. Not at all. Others are wrong about there are many interpretations of this, many ideas. But again, if you get in the minds of those people who first received the revelation, it becomes clear who this is. The description is of one who supports the worship of the first beast. He makes an image of the first beast. He tells the people to worship the first beast. So what is it? What is this? This is the imperial cult. They knew exactly who it was when they heard this prophecy because they were suffering, some of them were, because of what the imperial cult was doing. So you had this governmental element, cruel governmental element here, which used religion for its own purposes, or used emperor worship for its own purposes, and then you had the imperial cult to push, support, and back the worship of the emperor. That's what was going on here. And that's what these people undoubtedly understood these prophecies. Now, I'd like to go back again inside the minds of the people who received the revelation, and let's focus for a few moments on some of the things that they knew, some of the things they'd heard, the news reports that circulated around to them in those days, and some of the perspective they had. During the reign of Claudius, he was the Roman emperor who reigned from AD 41 to 54. During that reign, his third wife, Valeria Messalina, you ever heard of her? Valeria Messalina. She's actually rather well known. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Now, some of it may be, it's hard to tell sometimes where history ends and historical fiction begins. But when you hear the reports, all you have are the reports. And Tacitus reported these things, a historian. At least one other historian reported these things. And even those modern historians are not sure as to how much of it's true, evidently it's rooted in facts. But Messalina, was the third wife of Emperor Claudius. Third one. She became the most powerful woman in the empire, and everybody knew it. There were statues of her all around because she was honored. They honored her officially on her birthday. She was considered the Empress of Rome, the wife of Claudius. She was well liked, at least for a period of time. Like I say, her birthday was observed, was celebrated. They had the statue. She had many other privileges. She was also an expert in the art of manipulation. She was cruel, and she could manipulate the emperor for political gain. You know, a lot of times in those days, marriages on the part of emperors was a political arrangement anyway. It's not like some kind of love story you see coming out of Hollywood, but it's just political expediency oftentimes. Well, this seemed to be the case, and certainly she knew how to use her influence. Claudius appears to have been the type of person who could be easily manipulated, and she used all of her power to do just that. She did it for political gain, and if you happen, by the way, to be one of her political opponents, that could be some bad news. You'd either wind up with your head off or in exile. It's a bad thing to be her opponent. If she perceived that you were her opponent, and she would persuade Claudius to do these things for her. And sometimes it was his own family members, some of his own relatives, like a niece or whatever, he would send into exile or possibly even have put to death. Well, she had another problem in addition to this, the cruelty, the craving of power, the political maniac that she was. She had another little problem. It is not clear, again, about the facts, how much of it is true and how much of it is exaggerated. But what was known of her at that time, and what is believed about her, is that she was, in fact, she was considered a nymphomaniac. Her promiscuity is legendary. Legendary. Allegedly, as soon as she would hear Claudius snoring, she donned her wig, put on her harlot outfit, and slipped off to the nearest brothel. Came back before daybreak. She did this with, and she used sex as a means of manipulation and of controlling politicians. She was notorious. Eventually, Claudius discovered that Messalina and one of her victim lovers were plotting to get rid of him. So he got rid of them. Never batted an eye. They said, according to the report, I guess this comes from Tacitus, according to the way it was reported, that when he sent someone to do the job, that they always gave you the option of go ahead and do it yourself. And she put the dagger up to her throat and just couldn't do it. So he helped her. You know, the guy who was sent shoved it on in there, did the job, in other words. And he went back then and reported to Claudius. Claudius, by the way, was at a dinner when this was going on. And it was reported that he never paused, never did bat an eye, never expressed any sorrow, never had any emotion whatsoever. He just said, "Pour me some more wine, please," and went on about his, as if nothing had happened. So that's a kind of a little interesting aside. But he did marry again. He married a woman whose name was Agrippina. Agrippina the Younger, or Agrippina the Second. This was his fourth wife. And, nowadays, a politician has been divorced before, even though it might have been 30 years ago and remarried since then. That's under scrutiny. Back then, the emperors went through them just one after another. Buying and selling animals, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, Agrippina. Now, she didn't have the problem that Messalina had. She didn't have the same problem as far as her promiscuity. She was not promiscuous, evidently. She was just a power-hungry, manipulative, evil woman. She had all the other problems Messalina had, but not the promiscuity. And she also, by the way, was the mother of someone whose name I'm sure you will recognize. Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, I believe is the way it is pronounced. You know who that is, don't you? You know him as Nero. She was the mother of Nero. That was his given name. The adoptive son of Claudius. And, of course, he was the one who succeeded Claudius. It wasn't the son of Messalina. His name was Britannicus. Wasn't him. It was Agrippina's son, Nero. And he was one horrible, horrible ruler. Evidently, the first few years was not so bad, but when he went insane. And he did some horribly insane things. And he went down in history, of course, as one of the worst all-time Roman emperors. Well, you know, I hope Claudius knew more about running the empire than he did picking women. Because he picked some bad ones. But again, you know, part of the reason for all of that is that these were political arrangements more than anything else. You just read down the list of names of the wives the different emperors had. You say, wait a minute, all these people were kinfolks, weren't they? They all had similar names. And it was political, for political gain. You know, this emperor marries the cousin or something, or the daughter of this powerful person over here. So there was political involvement there. Now, these women, I would say especially Messalina, epitomized Rome itself. The historian Tacitus said, quotation from Tacitus, he said, if I can find it here, separate the pages, said that Rome was the place, quote, where all the horrible and shameful things in the world congregate and find a home. So what a fitting symbol someone like Messalina would have been of the city of Rome itself. She epitomized what Rome was. Now, the people, again, who first received the revelation, knew these stories, knew of the corruption of Rome and her leaders. And by the way, the word Babylon was a code name for Rome. They knew all of this. And they knew of Messalina and Agrippina and of Nero and of the cruelty sometimes exhibited by the Roman rulers. So now, from their point of view, how do you think they understood Revelation chapter 17? Let's go there. Revelation 17. Says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. The word is porneia. It means immorality. It refers to promiscuity. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. There's that beast again. Who is this beast? We've identified the beast. And I assure you, this is who the beast was. It was the Roman Empire. What does this idea of a woman sitting, or a person sitting on a beast, what is symbolized there? I would say it symbolizes some kind of control, wouldn't you? If you're sitting on top of an animal, whether it's a camel or a horse or whatever it is, that means you're to some extent controlling that animal, hopefully. So here's this woman sitting on the beast, sitting on the Roman Empire. And we're told in verse 18, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. We're also told her name. So the woman was arrayed in purple, verse 4, and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great. There's that code name. The mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and of the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Now, do you think those people could have read this without thinking of certain personalities? I don't think so. Such as Messalina. And not that I'm not saying this was speaking of Messalina. I'm saying it's probably a reference to her because she epitomized what Rome was. And of course, it's identified here in verse 18 as that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Obviously, it's talking about the city of Rome. And using this symbolism that those people would have readily recognized. Now, I skipped over something in Revelation 13. I'd like to go back to it. Charles talked about this last week, about the mark of the beast. I think I've got that one figured out too, by the way. The mark of the beast. Let's start there in verse 16. It says, he causes all, both great and small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of the name. Now, I've heard before that some have said, well, there are three things here. One is the mark, the other thing is the name, and the final thing, the third thing, is the number. I don't believe that's correct. Some of the other manuscripts, some of the ancient manuscripts, do not have that first word, or, when it says who has the mark or the name. What it means is those who have the mark, that is to say, the name or the number of the name. It's one thing. It's a name in their foreheads, a name. And that name is represented by its numerical equivalent. So it's just one thing. The name of the beast is in the numerical, or is in the number. The number, it says, is 666, as we read there in verse 18. Now, this number was probably not the first time those people heard of that number. They were familiar with this idea, this practice of having a number that equaled the name. You know, as far as if you figure each letter of a name, and each one has a numerical value, and then you count it up. This was not something those people were not familiar with. They understood that. And the number 666 was probably something they already knew about. They already knew that if you translated Nero Caesar to Hebrew, that it came out to 666. So they would have readily recognized Nero Caesar. Now, this was probably written after the time of Nero Caesar. So what's he saying here? You know, there was a myth that widely circulated in the Roman Empire. And that is that Nero Caesar would rise from the dead and lead a rebellion against Rome and take over the Roman Empire. Now, obviously that didn't happen. But the other godless emperors who expressed the same godliness that Nero did were, in a sense, you know, the spirit of Nero reigned on, you might say. So Nero was the prototype. He was the forerunner. And the 666, therefore, would apply to everyone who reigned in the style of Nero. Everyone who reigned godlessly. This would include the Emperor Domitian in the late first century, at the time this was probably written. So here again, you have a reference that identifies the Roman Empire as the beast. And again, these people would have recognized that immediately. Now, in chapter 14, there's something here that people miss. And all those who say that the mark of the beast is a computer chip, you know, implanted in maybe the back of the hand or in the forehead, you hear a thing. If you have what kind of radio they call shortwave radio, you can pick up all kinds of stuff like that, about reports about things like that going on and the plans of the government to do that. And it never seems to happen, but there's all kind of things out there that you can hear. And we have material coming to the office. Those of you who read the letters see these things all the time, you know, some kind of computer chip or whatever. Of course, in our tradition, it has been said, and is still claimed by some, that this is a reference to a national Sunday law, or perhaps an international Sunday law. I'm going to show you the weakness of that argument. The weakness of that argument, as opposed to Sabbath. You know, we just read that the mark of the beast is the name of the beast. And that name is that name in its numerical, or, you know, according to its numerical equivalent. That's the code for the name, in other words, the same thing. In chapter 14, verse 1, we see the contrast. And it's not a weekday or day of the week. It's something else. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his Father's name written on their foreheads. The Father's name is here contrasted with the name of the beast. That's what it's talking about. What does that mean? It's a reference to those who have the mark of the beast, or have the name of the beast on their foreheads or on their right hand. It's a reference to their allegiance to the beast. Those who have the Father's name in their forehead, this simply means a symbolic way of speaking of their allegiance to the Father. Two opposites. That's what it means. That's what the mark of the beast is. You know, I seriously doubt that there is a visible mark. I don't think that the mark of the beast, and this is my opinion, could be wrong. Now, on this one, I could be wrong. The rest of it is right. This part could be wrong. And that is that, in my opinion, there is no visible mark. This is all symbolism. It's a symbolic way of describing who you give your allegiance to. You don't have to have any kind of mark. You don't have to it's not a matter of which day. That's not what's at stake here. That's another subject for another time. But this is in reference to who your allegiance is to. Now, just as an aside and something I think you will find interesting, go back to Revelation chapter 2. I think I wrote it down. Let me just make sure. Revelation chapter 2. I still know where it is. It's in the church, to the church in Smyrna. Notice what he says here in verse 9. He says, I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. What's he talking about here? Who are those who say they're Jews but are not, but are the synagogue of Satan? No doubt they were. I know it says they're not really Jews, but they were Jews. They were people who called themselves Jews. They were like those who were involved with the Roman beast in the time of Christ and who said, we have no king but Caesar. Remember that? When Christ was in the hands of the Roman beast, in the person of Pontius Pilate in this case, and when they ask about their king, you know, the Messiah is king, they said, we have no king but Caesar. You see, they were in collusion with the beast. The same thing was apparently going on here in this particular church. In Smyrna. Or not in the church, but in the city of Smyrna. Apparently there was a synagogue there. And for their own purposes, their own protection, you know, for their own gain, they were in collusion with the Roman Empire. And some have suggested that perhaps they were acting as watchdogs for the empire. That's to preserve their own, you know, what they had for themselves. Listen, I'll alone. You know, let's work out this deal. Let's have this arrangement here. And apparently the Romans did have such an arrangement. They had that arrangement with the Jews in the time of Jesus. Now, when I say the Jews, I'm not talking about all Jews, obviously, and you can't label all synagogues just by the synagogue in Smyrna. Now, this was a synagogue. It's called a synagogue of Satan because these people actively persecuted the Christians there. They were in collusion with the Roman beast. In other words, they gave their allegiance to Rome. Again, I may be wrong, but I would say they had the mark of the beast. You think? Guess what? They were strict Sabbath keepers and holy day observers. They didn't eat any pork or catfish or shrimp. I'm not flinging a craving on anybody, I hope. Or lobster or any of those things. And yet, in my view, they had the mark of the beast. The mark of the beast has to do with your allegiance to an ungodly force. Now, as I said at the outset, I would identify the beast, and I believe I have. And I'm sure of it. But there's something I haven't yet covered. I'm not going to do it today. Haven't covered. And this has to do with the nature of biblical prophecy. Prophecies generally do not exhaust themselves in their initial fulfillments. An example of that is the prophecy of Joel. When God says through the prophet Joel, in the latter days, I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters will prophesy. On the day of Pentecost, Simon Peter stood up and said, this is that, when the Holy Spirit was poured out. This is that spoken of by the prophet Joel. Was it or was it not? Yes, it was. What was spoken by the prophet Joel was fulfilled that day, but was it exhausted? Was its fulfillment exhausted? The answer is no. No, it wasn't. I don't doubt at all that there have been outpourings of the Spirit from that time to this in various places, some of which we don't even know about. And I don't doubt at all that there will be, in the final crisis, another great outpouring of the Spirit. You can make a case, a very strong case for that. So prophecies are not exhausted, generally speaking, in their initial fulfillments. So what does that mean? It means simply that we most likely will see the same patterns. In fact, we see some of the same patterns we see right here in the book of Revelation. You have the political and religious powers at work together, and the saints being persecuted as a result of this. You see those same patterns at various places through history. And I doubt not that we will see them in the crisis at the close of the age. So, on that point, I would have to say, I'm in 100% agreement with Charles. You don't know who the beast is. That is to say, the end time beast. We can identify the one who is initially spoken of here, the one that the first Christians who read these prophecies knew about. That's clearly the beast. But if we're going to have any kind of inkling as to what kind of powers that we face in this world, we will face in the crisis at the close, if we're living at that time, then we need to start with the original instructions here and understand that persecutions do come to God's people. They come in a multitude of forms, but it seems that the patterns are always basically the same. So we can look at this, and it does tell us something about the end time. It does tell us that there are antichrists, many antichrists in the world, and no doubt we will experience, or at least somebody, whether it's us or a next generation or a generation, will experience that final antichrist who will come at the close of this age.